Hello and a very warm welcome to Business by Outra, the sports and business podcast. My name is Kim Schulze and I regularly have the honor of talking to special personalities from the outdoor and sporting good industry. In cooperation with Outra, the ecosystem for the outdoor bike and sports industry, whose digital tools optimize the customer journey and increase the sales of brands and their retail partners. Together, we look at relevant content through the eyes of industry experts and enthusiasts. Hello and a very warm welcome to Spbusiness, the sport business podcast on the media platform Sport1. My name is Kim Schulze and I regularly have the honor of talking to special personalities from the sports and outdoor industry. We look at the sports and outdoor market at relevant content through the eyes of industry experts. I'm really looking forward to my meeting today with Adrian Margalist, Chief Creative Director, Burton Snowboards. Hello, dear Adrian.
Hi, Kim. Nice to be here with you.
Same. So our conversation means really a lot to me. On one hand, because I appreciate you, Adrian, in person so much. And on the other hand, because it's sports. We know each other from your career at Mammut. Can you tell us a little about yourself, your career, and what made you change from outdoor, from fashion to outdoor to sports?
Sure. I mean, yeah, maybe my career has been a bit special, so to say. I mean, I grew up in a little tiny village in the Swiss Alps in Valais, and was involved and exposed to a lot of outdoors and mountain activities. And I grew up in a working class environment, so there was not much of fashion or creativity around. But for some reason, when I was 16, I all of a sudden got like the lightning bolt went off and I said, I'm going to become a famous designer. And everyone was like, okay, that's interesting. Yeah, probably it's just a flask, but I took it very serious. So I went my path and I started design and brought all my creativity, which started quite early. When I was 10, I already did graffiti and I did a lot of illustrations for school papers and stuff like that. So I really brought my creativity into a fashion design career, so to say, and did my path there on a regular way from junior designer to senior designer, head of design, art director, creative director. And then like 12 years ago, I figured out that the fashion side or the entrepreneurial side within fashion was really intriguing me and triggered something of my interest. And I thought, if I could combine maybe an entrepreneurial sense with a creative point, I could probably create a very unique profile of myself. And that's what I started to do. So I changed from being a designer as such to be a very entrepreneurial creative. And that's why I started becoming a C-level within the fashion industry. And I had the chance to travel the world for 18 years. I mean, I lived in Milan, I lived in London, I lived in Dusseldorf. Then I moved to Seoul, South Korea, then back to Berlin. And finally, as you said, 5 years ago, I got the call from Mammut, outdoor specialist, which to me was like, that's a very different world. But since I knew the brand since being growing up in the mountaineering environment, as said, I thought, like, this is a really great chance and opportunity. I mean, it's a 160-year-old brand from Switzerland, me being Swiss. And that was the reason they called me. They said, we need to change this brand and we need to make it fresh. And you have this global eye, but you're a mountain boy by heart. And I think there's not many out there which have that profile we are looking for. So I took the opportunity and moved back to Switzerland, and that's where I am since 5 years now.
It's really impressive what you just mentioned, very humble, how your industry career was and where you all lived, but maybe you can mention some brands and what you did with them and for them, because I guess this is important to understand the next 45 minutes what you are up to.
Sure. It started already very special because as said, the environment I'm coming from, we were not ready to dive into such career. So I had the luck that my 13-year-old brother, who already made some money as a banker in Switzerland, Zurich, he believed in me and he invested in me. So he paid all my studies. So that was already a very special beginning, because I'm the only child out of four who had the ability to study, thanks to my brother. And we then said, if you want to have an international career, because we figured out pretty quickly that Switzerland is not relevant in the fashion industry as much. I mean, of course, we have Acris, we have Bali, but that's more or less it. So we did some research and figured out, okay, Milan, there is a great master in Milan at the Istituto Marangoni. And that's where we decided to go for my master. But then we figured out that we only had money for 8 months. And they said, yeah, it's impossible. The shortest master ever done was 13 months. And I said, I'm going to do it. They were like, yeah, you're going to waste your money, but okay, be our guest. So long story short, I did my master in 8 months. And I graduated with 30 out of 30 points. And at that school, WGSN nominated Marangoni as the best school of planet Earth. So I graduated at the best school on planet Earth with 30 of 30 points in a record time of 8 months. And that brought me to my first job in London, where I started my career at Vivienne Westwood. So yeah, the beginning was already very, very special. So the 25-year-old kid from the 10,000 people village in the Swiss Alps, packing his luggage and moving to London and starting his career at Vivienne Westwood, that was a very special time. And yeah, from there, as I said before, I did my path and I worked at Vivienne Westwood. Then I had the chance to get a job at Esprit back in the days, a very successful environment, a little bit different than it is today. And I got a head of design job at Esprit, and I learned a lot there in the fast fashion industry, because 12 collections a year. So I learned a lot of the sourcing and supply side. And from there, I decided to go back to the high-end luxury world, because I really appreciated that very much, the whole craftsmanship and the love to detail and the quality. So I worked then for Fabric Frontline, which was a very high-end manufacturer for silk fabrics. So I worked for all the couturiers in Paris, New York, Milan. I worked for Lagerfeld, Lacroix, Bill Blass, Dior, Chanel, you name them. So I created all the catwalk fabrics for those guys. That's what I did for 4 years. So I learned a lot about textiles. And then I got the offer from Mrs. Sangju Kim, when she bought the brand MCM in 2008, to become the global artistic director for MCM. And I thought, that's a really great opportunity, because it was a really old brand from Munich, 1976, very dusty, very done. And I always loved challenges. And I said, I'm going to do that. And everyone said, oh boy, you just ruined your career. I mean, why would you go to that brand? It's done. I said, yeah, but that's the cool thing. If you go somewhere which is already moving, what's the point? There's nothing to change. So you just keep going. So I really love challenges to move things, to change things, to turn around things. And I started there in 2008. And I think it's quite history what happened to the brand. I mean, we literally flipped the brand to a global streetwear luxury brand. So actually 12 years before all the other luxury brands figured out that the clash with streetwear is cool. And that was then the breakthrough for my global career, because I was really exposed to the global industry, the global media, the global press. And it was also where I figured out, I'm actually an entrepreneur. I'm a change maker. I'm a turnaround manager. That's what I'm able to do best, to motivate and bring people along to change things. And that's where I then really decided to put all my chips on that one field and to group my career or put the needle towards that direction. So today I call myself a brand shaper, and I usually get called by brands who it's rather too late or who need some change, who need global positioning or whatsoever. So I don't get phone calls from the brands who are running well. I get phone calls from the brands who want to move on, who want to do some change.
It's impressive how your energy works. And I really remember the first moments on ISPO when you just started with Mammut. And maybe it is interesting for all people listening to us what's now different with Burton compared to your previous jobs and what makes you tick in that role.
I think what's different is that Burton is a very well-running corporate. So it's less about turnaround, is much more about what's next, what's the next chapter, what's the next position. I mean, as we know, Mammut was a clear turnaround management and the company was loss-making. And then we got called, Oliver Pops and myself, to really turn the company around, and that's what we did. Here at Burton, it's a well-running, family-owned business. And as you all know, unfortunately, 2 years ago, Jake Burton Carpenter, the founder and owner and heart and soul of the company, passed away. So after almost 40 years, it was a big vacuum at the company because he was like the pillar, the heart and soul. And it was like, oh my gosh, what's next? So no one really thought what's going to happen with that brand and what's next. And then Donna Carpenter, Jake's wife and widow, decided we're going to make this legacy even bigger and we're going to find the right people. And I got to meet Donna and we got along quite well, and she understood that I'm probably the guy they are looking for and that I probably can support the family to take Jake's legacy and to bring it together with the whole team to the next level. And that's the challenge I'm in now since a year, or the opportunity, and working full force with the teams to make it happen. And it's a very, very interesting job because I'm between the family and the corporate, and it's a very beautiful, beautiful experience. And they have three sons, and each senior leader is like mentor to one son, and I'm mentor to Timmy, the youngest, who takes over now the Mind 77, Jake's true legacy. And so it's between being a big entrepreneur and being like almost a father figure or an elderly brother figure, and between true business from rational to emotional. So it's a very, very interesting and amazing opportunity I got here.
Unbelievable. So maybe to get the holistic picture, you said you just came back from 1 month being there. As this is a sport business podcast related to the personalities of our industry, maybe you can give us like a short roundabout on facts, figures, what makes the market shares right now, where do you see the board sport and outdoor industry? What is the whole thing around at the moment?
I mean, in general, as we can see, the board sports really having a renaissance. I mean, surfing is booming, skating is back, and so is snowboarding. And I mean, we were the first generation snowboarders. I started snowboarding as really the underdog in 1987. So I was really in the first wave of that sport. And I know the industry, I know the sport, and I know the brand. And then the boom days were the 90s and early 2000s. I mean, snowboarding was like crushing it. And then, yes, it had a downturn, and Generation Y was less snowboarders. So, and now we can see that the Gen X is racing the Gen Z, and they becoming riders again because they get it from the first generation. And now we have the chance to create the second wave. So snowboarding is really on an uptrend. We can see it on the figures in the resorts. We can see it from the figures on the business. And then the board sport side is one factor, of course, where we build on. That's the core. But then on the other hand, the whole outdoor is still booming, and it's booming in all directions, and the melting from outdoor to streetwear, where of course a board brand is per se already cooler. So the spread from being a board sport brand to more urban is much easier than being a true mountaineering brand, because we already have the coolness factor. And then what's happening is China just really experiences the first wave of snowboarders, and it's wild. I mean, it's like the 90s over here. It's like punk and anarchy, and it's happening. And now we've Beijing just in front of our doors in January, and with the Chinese riders being Olympic potentials, and of course Jiayu, the biggest Chinese Olympic female rider, riding on the right board, on our board, of course. So it's a lot of exciting stuff happening, and I think it's really the second wave of snowboarding, and we are just in the middle of it.
A short break. Here comes an independent commercial. Commercial done, back to our conversation. And is there something you would love to share figure-wise? What do you see as like salt boards, or as you were mentioning, the resorts, and coming to climate change later on, but now seeing it as a perspective, as you said, entrepreneur-wise? Is there anything you want to share?
I mean, I can't share figures from the company since we are a family-owned business and we don't share figures, but we are on a very good growth path, and we are on a very successful, profitable path. And when you can see, even last year, where most resorts were closed, everyone tried someone to do business. I mean, Switzerland took a very own path. All the resorts were open. The US took a path. They tried to have the resorts open. And we can really see that the figures. So snowboarding is growing now faster than skiing is growing again. And that's a very great indicator, because the last 15 years, it was more a downtrend on the snowboarding. And since two seasons now, we can see that the CAGR of the snowboard growth is much bigger again than the CAGR of the skiing growth. And of course, we are also very, very close to people from the skiing industry. I mean, in general, at Burton, we are a very open-minded environment. And we talk a lot to other senior leaders, to other CEOs from other big brands, because we believe in exchange and cooperation such, and less competition, because at the end of the day, we all want a piece of the cake. And if you try to make the whole cake bigger, each piece of the cake is going to be bigger. So that's a bit our philosophy and ideology. So yes, we can see that the tendency is definitely going in the right direction.
And seeing what you were mentioning in terms of shoulder-to-shoulder approaches in the industry, Burton was always, and this is where my roots were in my starting career, it was always enormously progressive in various fields of play. So can you guide us through the most important like pillars or thoughts you have towards market, culture, sustainability? What do you see in your eyes and also out of the eyes of the industry and Burton?
Sure. I mean, yeah, you mentioned Burton was always more on the progressive side. And when we see of market development, I definitely say that we are the most progressive now in the Chinese market. I mean, we go full force, and it's an open secret. It's public that we have a joint venture in China with Hill House, which is a huge portfolio. And Lei, the owner of Hill House, he established brands like Adidas, Nike, and so on in China. So big, big, big business. And having Lei as our partner is just amazing, because he's our unicorn, as we call him, because beside him knowing the market and his portfolio, Hill House, knowing how to establish brands, he himself is a snowboarder by heart. I mean, when we give up by minus 25 degrees and we rather go and see you later, we go for a hot chocolate. He's still riding out there, and it's really, really amazing to see how passionate Lei is, this big entrepreneur in China, is supporting the sport. So that's progression on one hand. Then when it comes to progression on the regular side of product, yes, we are truly led by innovation, and that's where it all started. I mean, Jake started in 1977 in a shed, in a barn, doing his own boards, and that's the core DNA. So it was always about building the best.
Hey, this is a commercial. Do you know what Deuter, Ortovox, Atomic Bergans, DeWalt, Sport 2000, Bechley, Sportler, Schuster, and Globetrotter, plus several other outdoor brands have in common? They are outdoor enthusiasts, yes, of course. And they work together with the Outra ecosystem, which is a game changer for brands and retailers. The Outra tools for data exchange and data analysis enable a flow of sales like you've never experienced before. With Outra, where to buy, consumers can directly see on a brand's website in which stores a product is available. With the Outra Data and Image Hub, brands and retailers can finally exchange product data and images efficiently. Interested in testing the Data and Image Hub? Take the opportunity and request a free demo of the with your brand-specific data. It pays you back quickly. The offer is valid until Outdoor by ISPO in June 2024. Sign up for this ecosystem and become a major player in outdoor bike and sports industry. Contact and information at outra.com with a double T.
Creating the best, being better than the others, and leading by innovation and creating performance and technicality. And when it comes to pillars here, of course, we want to be leading in many fields, but hard goods is, of course, our true core. And with our new step-on technology, the binding without straps, it's really something now. We revolutionized the market again. And we are the first ones now who shape 3D boards. So that's a new thing in the pipeline, which is quite radical and sick. We are working on...
Just a question in between for those who are not as much into the market as we are. Can you explain what does that mean for riding or for technology, if you say 3D?
I mean, the 3D board is really... it creates a new riding, because regular boards were either flat or they had a camber where you say they were pre-tensioned, or they have a rocker where they have like a bending towards the ground. And then you had a bit like skiing. You had boards made for the piste, or boards made more for free ride in the powder, or boards made for freestyle and park. So it's pretty similar. But it's the regular wooden core with the metal edges. So it's the same sandwich technique like ever. But now with this 3D technology, we manage to shape boards in a complete new way. Literally in every direction we want to shape them, everywhere on the board we want to shape them. So that means that the detailing of riding becomes such more granular, because we can influence the shape almost on every inch of the board, rather than say core, nose, tail, and both backside and front side. So we can specialize the riding style much more customized on each board, if that makes sense.
Exciting. Yeah, it makes total sense. Is there any other innovation you want to share?
No.
What a pity.
It would be too early. But I can tell you, as you know me, Kim, as you know me, and if you've seen the last 4 years at the Swiss brand, you can imagine that I'm not sitting and waiting. I'm pushing and pulling the team out of comfort zones, and there's amazing stuff in the hopper. But I can tell you one is textile related. without going into much detail, which I believe there's room to revolutionize, and one is footwear related. So the
various.
It's all about to enhance the performance. That's what it is.
Curious. We need to do another one in winter, in high winter. So maybe having a little sidestep towards climate change, to what that means for world sport industry, for outdoor industry. Is there something you want to share from your thoughts? Because I know that you're heavy into like doing business right. So maybe you can share your thoughts on that.
And here I really start personally. It's really bothering me, and it's really worrying me to see where we are at and where we as humankind are heading to. And I think it's just a disaster, and it's a disaster to see that no one literally gives a damn. And I mean, Johan Rockström is explaining us in 22 minutes pretty clear and pretty simple that the point of no return is almost crossed, but people think, yeah, the other one can solve it, but we cannot. So it's really worrying me. And I also think that the discussion is wrong, because we talk about, oh, we need to save the planet. Now, the planet will save himself. So the discussion should be, do we really want to save human race? So do we really want that human beings are still on this planet in 100 years, 200 years, 300 years? And if the answer is yes, we need to change something. If the answer is like everyone likes, I don't care, I don't give a damn because I live now, then okay. Then the discussion is most probably if we continue the way we do, in 30, 40, 50, 100 years, there won't be no human anymore, because it's science-based. It's not like, oh, it could happen or it couldn't happen. It's science-based. I mean, it's pretty clear. If you don't manage the 1.5% heat increase, it's going to look pretty terrible. So I try to do personally as much as I can. Yes, I fly around the world. I try to do it carbon neutral. I change my cars. I change my way of living. I try to have my microcosmos as good as possible. And that's why also, to me, when I got the chance working for Burton, I was really, really stoked about, because we are really, really advanced and forward, I would say, even in the outdoor industry, not just at the board sports. I mean, we are B Corp. We have just announced the 25 global goals. We think philanthropic. We give everything back to the environmental changes. We try to be carbon neutral by 2025. So we are doing so much, but we don't really talk about. So yes, to me, the climate change is definitely real and something that bothers me almost every day. Also having a 14-year-old son and trying to educate him and trying to tell him that the new generation should put all their efforts and great qualities and skill sets and talents they bring to invest in hopefully getting the climate change under control.
I remember when I started working with the sustainability projects for ISPO, I had a lot to do with Ellie Kenny, and she was so heavy into all the conversations, being also with Barack Obama together. So there are roots. Can you share some of those? Because I guess in Europe it's totally different working with the governmental sides.
It's different, and yeah, Ali is definitely our forefront, and she got promoted the Chief Strategy Officer, and sustainability is one of her topics. But we have great people with Emily Foster running the whole thing. But I think what's really, really impressive at Burton is that really we managed to establish it as a mindset. And even when we start on the product side, some questions like, oh, this is a cool fabric, but it's not blue sign, can we utilize it? That question doesn't even come up, because we know we can't utilize it. So it's really Ali and the team managed to establish it on a mindset base and really to infiltrate the whole organization that, hey, this is the way we're heading to. Donna started that very, very early. It's all driven by Donna, and Jake adapted to it, and everyone agreed that this is the way we want to go to, because at the end of the day, it's pretty simple. No winter, no snowboard. I mean, if you want to remain our business, and if we want to remain our business to give back, even to become carbon positive, then we need to move towards that direction. And yeah, we have so much progress in place. I mean, as I said, Blue Sign is one, but then the carbon neutral as a first step, then the carbon positive as a second step is in place. We just announced that we give an amount of turnover one-on-one in cash back to environmental projects. So a lot of things are happening.
Thank you for sharing that. Is there any critical point you want to share? What do you do different at Burton compared to your other career steps? Or where are your personal challenges, hurdles? It's always so interesting to hear from inspiring persons as you are, what to learn from, or let's call it like a leadership role you have, not only for the brands you're working with, but also for the industry. So what can you share on that side?
What's interesting for me is that, I mean, I've worked for European corporates, of course. I worked in an Asian environment when I worked for Mrs. Kim in Seoul, South Korea. Now it's the first time I work for an American corporate. And I don't know if it's a regular American corporate since it's family owned, so I can't compare it to others. But it's to me also something new, but new in a positive way, because I'm a very curious, open person and I want to learn every day something myself. And now being the only non-American in the board of an American family-owned corporate is a very unique role in a good sense. And I often go like, global lens. So they go like, oh my God, why did we hire the dude from over there? He's getting on our nerves. But it's my role, because I'm here to bridge the markets, North America, Europe, and Asia. And I think they appreciate more than they think I'm going on their nerves. But America's so big, and America as a market is so big. And you see all the big competitors. I mean, we know them, like Columbia, North Face, Patagonia. They make so much money just in that one single market. Then you often tend to see things just through the one lens. And my opportunity here is really to bring them along and say, hey, we have so much more opportunity because we are the number one global snowboard brand. And I believe there's always a 75% of global overlap. And if we manage to create that, our triggers and opportunities are going to be so much more. So I think it's the first time in my career that I sort of play the role of being the immigrant, but in a good way. And because when you work as a Swiss for a Swiss company, you're like you belong to the core by nature. But if you work for an American corporate being the European kit, it gives you a different perspective. And I appreciate it because I learn a lot. I learn how to navigate with Americans in a good sense, because every culture is different and we know that. And everyone, the way they grow up, the point of view is different. So I would say it's good stuff I'm learning here.
So where's your source of energy and your source of passion? Where do you get that from?
Oh, that's a really good question, Kim. I think I got it in my crib. I think I was born with it. I think I'm just a positive spirit. I think life is short in general. And then I go like with the really simple ideology, why should I waste my time of being negative? Or why should I waste my time of something I can't influence? like people moaning about things which they have zero influence, which I go like, dude, what's the point? So I rather try to spend positive energy on the things I know I can influence. And I'm a big believer in the butterfly effect. So I believe if I influence things in my little microcosmos, sooner or later they will influence somewhere else because it's a chain reaction. So if I send a little smile to the woman in the bakery who gives me the bread in the morning and she lightens up and she gives it further and she goes home for lunch and is positively... So it's just these little human interactions. I think that gives me energy in general. And on the other hand, I just love what I do. And I know that I'm so fortunate coming from where I'm coming from and having this amazing opportunity the last 15 years of having such a path career-wise. My career became my life. And to me, I'm not working. I'm just a very fortunate man to be able to do what I do. And so...
You are the source yourself.
I'm the source of myself, exactly. Doctor, be your own patient, right?
So before coming to some other personal questions at the end of our podcast, it would be great if your mind and your mindset gives us a picture of what you see, what comes next, what's the big thing for us, for consumers, apart, of course, from all the climate activities you were also mentioning we all need to do and all be butterflies. But what's the next thing in your head?
I think it's two things. The belief what's next or the wish and hope what's next. And to me, these are two different things. Yeah, of course, and this is nothing new and probably everyone tells you the same. I mean, the digitization and the world becoming a village and pushing an order button on an Instagram account and the thing is the next morning in your mailbox. That definitely changed consuming behavior big time. Is it good or bad? I really don't know. I think constant access to everything, anytime, everywhere, I don't really think it's good because the bubble is going to get bigger and most probably it's going to burst one day. So that's a reality and that's where we need to adapt ourselves as well. And yes, we want to be digital retailer of the future as well, as many others as well. One thing is we definitely want to talk to the consumer, but more building a community than building a consumer base, because we believe as more people believe in our ideology of we ride together and the togetherness is the key of change, as more we can achieve. And then the wish of the future, if I would have a wish to say how the future should be, I would like to see a slower future. But probably I will not witness that anymore because I learned today is the slowest day in our lives we ever going to experience. Same is going to be tomorrow and same is going to be the day after tomorrow. Since it's changing exponentially, I mean, 5G is out there, quantum computing is just around the corner. It's wild. So, but then that's why I choose my own little thing here. I have my own mountain hut up here with no Wi-Fi. So I have the hotspot now and talking to you. And I do believe every tendency has a counter tendency by nature. And that's a good thing. So I do believe, and I do see it in my environment, more and more people, they want to reduce the speed of their own life. So the hope is still up. I don't give up on the hope yet.
Is there a pledge or a wish for our industry you want to share?
I think our industry is doing good. And that's why I really enjoy now being in this industry since 5 years. And I know never say never, but I probably will never go back to the fashion industry anymore, because it's not fitting to my ideology anymore. Because we here produce things to keep them as long as possible, to make them durable as long as possible, to make them sustainable. So not only the way we produce them, but we also want our consumer to buy less. We want them to buy quality and buy less. So it really makes sense to me. Do we save the world? No, probably not. I mean, we still produce things, but we try to do it as carbon neutral, and we try to give it to the consumer in a way that we know the consumer can enjoy the product for a very long time. And then still the fashion industry, I mean, Kering, LVMH, they all talk about sustainability and fur free now and blah, blah, blah. But the ideology is wrong, because if you produce every 6 months a catwalk to sell the newest chisel to people, it just doesn't make sense. So I'm happy, and I think the outdoor industry is doing very well, to answer your question.
Thank you very much. So if you are prepared, there are some short and personal questions for the end of our podcast. It could all be whether positive or challenging, in the sense of how could this happen to me. So are you ready?
I'm ready, Kim.
Your most awkward business moment.
I'm not ready. Let me think. My most awkward business moment.
And as we both speak German and English, in German you would say dein peinlichster business moment. So that's a little easier. I did not find a proper translation for the English one. So,
okay, I tell you one, but I need to tell that one in German.
Okay.
Ich habe mal irgendwo bei einem Lieferanten eine Hose anprobiert. Und dann saß die relativ eng, und da habe ich gedacht, ey, das kann doch nicht sein, das kann ja keine M sein, das kann kein M sein. Und dann wollte ich so hinten in meine Hose reingucken, was das Hangtag sagt, oder? Und da war aber kein Hangtag drin. Und dann stehe ich vor dem Lieferanten mit der Hose halb runter in meiner Hand und sage vor allen, bei mir steht nichts in der Hose. Und das war ziemlich peinlich. Weil alle dann gekichert haben und ich so, hä? Ich habe dann echt 5 Sekunden gebraucht, bis mir dann auch der Groschen gefallen ist. Ich so, okay, I only was talking about the hang tag and nothing else. So, that was quite an awkward moment.
Your biggest surprise?
My biggest surprise? Mm-hmm. My son surprises me almost on a daily business very positively. So, he's a great big surprise.
Your most outstanding idea?
Oh, yeah, I always have a lot of crazy ideas. I think in general, coming into brands and flipping them upside down, it really starts as a very crazy, wild idea, because the people who are there since decades, they go like, what's wrong with this kid? So... I think in general, I'm a big thinker anyway, so I wouldn't really be able to say this is my biggest idea I ever had.
So it relates directly to the next question, your craziest trip, which could be with a personal or in real or whatever.
Oh, but there I know one. I was once traveling for 21 days around the globe with Mrs. Kim for MCM back then. And it was a wild ride.
We could fill millions of hours with all your trips.
That could be a whole podcast episode.
Exactly. Adrian, your best deal?
My best deal? Every deal.
Your contribution to make the world a little better?
I said before, I try to be a good human, as good as I can, and to keep my microcosmos as good as I can, and try to be a positive source for many, and that's what it is.
Your most inspiring moment?
I get inspired by so many things, and then I tried to turn it around. I tried to be an inspiration, and that's how I lead my people, as guiding them and inspiring them and enabling them to become their own source of positivity and happiness and inspiration. And that's, to me, the way of giving and developing people. So I know my answers are like so random or so open, but that's what it is.
Your most reliable source. I guess I know the answer.
But it is, at the end of the day, I'm closest to myself. So it's going to be me, unfortunately, or fortunately. Fortunately for me, and maybe unfortunately for my surrounding. But I'm honest. When it comes really hard on heart, I stand very close to myself.
Can you recommend a book, a podcast, or a film what inspired you recently?
Yeah, the last one I just watched, but it's out there everywhere right now, it's Squid Game. And of course, me having lived in Korea for 6 years, I know the culture quite well. So I understood some subconscious things in there, maybe different than a regular watcher, but I think it was pretty twisted and quirky, but in a good sense. So it was quite inspiring to me. I loved the editing of it. I loved the way it was shot. So yeah, it was pretty cool.
Thank you. And how can people get in touch with you if they want to be inspired by you?
Actually, I'm very humble and open and easy approachable. I mean, I get so many mails via LinkedIn, or even my personal email can be found on the World Wide Web. And I get back to everyone, even if it's a student or a CEO, I don't care. I think just a quick thank you for reaching out to everyone is, it doesn't cost you anything than a couple seconds of your life. So everyone can reach out to me, and whenever I can help, I try to help, because I was once in the beginning of my career as well. So I appreciated help, and I try to live against the same ideology.
Thank you. We are at the end of our questions. I really appreciated our time being together. It was so long ago without the trade shows and with all traveling possible. So it's always very great to talk to you. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Kim. The pleasure was on my side, and really, yeah, appreciate that you have me for your podcast and to be one of these personalities you interview. And thanks for your time, Kim. Really appreciate it.
Same to you, and hope to see you soon. Share thoughts and energy. Take care.
Hey, to jump off with a personal message. Do you like my podcast or not? Then help me get better or stay good, preferably via LinkedIn. And please spread the word, share it, and make our content even more relevant. Thank you very much, and see you next time.